grassroots organizations and groups and individuals, and on the other hand, the big organizations, which bring care. Well, now I'm also part of a network of individuals who is preparing to become part of the World Social Forum in Tunisia next spring, but we have the same discussions on how can we participate without being organized, because you have to be an organization to join. But this is an ongoing discussion. Find a way.
Yes, I'm Jerry from Utrecht. And I've been involved in sort of events and struggles. I guess I've had some contact in the climate movement with NGOs and here to try and get an idea of the story Case was talking about, a bit about the history of relationship between social movements and NGOs and where did it all go wrong and how can we what is the difference between a small NGO that does good work and a big NGO that does good work and a small NGO that where's the good and where's the bad, and how can we change it for the better, or should we just stop it altogether, or whatever. So I'm looking forward to a debate.
I'm Chris from Klasse. I'm not going to say so much because I was actually preparing with Emma this workshop a bit, or brainstorming about it at least, which direction we could push the debate. But why I think that it is a very interesting topic to reflect about is indeed A, because it hits the heart of a lot of questions we're discussing here in Trade Air 5 in general, and that's a question of organization. I mean, you can't go around it, and clearly NGOs are historically one form of organization. So of social movements or whatever, protest, resistance, I don't know, civil society. And so I think it's important to unpack it and to look also in a critical but productive way at the history to learn how we can organize in the future. That I find, I think, very important.
Just for people who have come in, we were just very briefly introducing ourselves to one another, so if you want to.
Yeah, I'm Serge, I'm from Turkey, doing my PhD here, organizing and helping out supplying stuff.
I'm Dan, I'm in the organization of 20FF, and I'm very curious.
Great, I think that's everyone. Okay, fantastic. What we had planned for this workshop, and we haven't actually got that much time, so we are going to keep the momentum going. I'll do my best not to speak the NGO speak. What we're thinking of doing first was to just spend a few minutes just hearing from people what specific problems or issues that you have encountered either working within NGOs or trying to work with NGOs or being sort of part of a social movement, some of the issues that have come up for you. And we wanted to collect some of the concrete specific problems that people have had or issues that people have had, so that we're starting with a kind of concrete basis for our discussions. After collecting that, I was going to say a little bit about the history of NGOs and what I see as some of the kind of key problems, hopefully linking that to some of the issues that have come up, and then from there we would broaden out the discussion again and invite everyone to chip in, and hopefully in the end we might end up also with some action points or at least some points that we can take with us in our organizing. That is the hope. So unfortunately we don't really have any big pieces of paper, but I do have these small pieces of paper. So I don't know, my idea was we were just going to write things down on these pieces of paper, but maybe I will just do it with the small piece of paper instead. People won't be able to see it as well, I don't think, but at least we can collect some issues. So I just invite you to, I think we already had one case you had with the funding or issues of of money, but could you sort of formulate that as a problem? Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot. But
yeah, because it's a whole history of how they become. They start as genuine, like a form of organization. For instance, for solidarity with Chile, where there has been a coup. You know that's you have to have some kind of an office and a bank account and stuff like that. They all form part of this structure that you can call an NGO.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 10 or 15, well, best example is, for instance, the state bond with Nicaragua,
mm-hmm.
City solidarity with Nicaragua. There was a revolution in Nicaragua, and everybody wanted to be solidaric, and they organized these things. And so they turned into, at the end, you know, they had like paid personnel and doing stuff that was more or less the opposite of what they had started for. They were like doing development programs for the new liberal government in Nicaragua. And something happened in those 15 years that turned them into that. And it's not because the people who were active in it wanted it. It is because there's a very subtle way of filtering, like what kind of activities you get subsidy for and which you don't, you know. And then it's more or less this corrupts without initially people wanting that these organizations. And so in a way they are the part from Troje, the horse of Troje, from grassroots to movement. And there's so many examples of it that it's not a coincidence. How do you call it? It's geen Einzelfall.
It's not a coincidence.
No, it's not a single case.
All right, it's not an Einzelfall. Yeah.
It's structural, and I don't know how to deal with it, because there's also many good NGOs that still, you know, do research on multinationals or something like that. I mean, really need that research. But in general, many of the NGOs turn into vehicles for the existing system.
And companies.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put down service providers for governments, funding constraints, Trojan horses for neoliberalism. I'm trying to fit it on a very small piece of paper.
Other concrete examples from the experience of
that? I would like to add propaganda, because when you promote human rights, and for example you promote a no-fly zone over Libya, which kind of in a way legitimizes the whole intervention there, that's very misleading. Also cases on Syria and stuff like this, wrong information. And I think it's really, in a way, evil to misuse the good intentions of people who really believe in human rights and who really believe in peace, but not actually be critical. And also, I think it's not even possible for an organization to be that big, because the government would have already suppressed you down to become a, you know. Then also, for example, my organization, I'm part of a big international peace education. We're represented on all continents. And it's awesome. The stuff that we teach kids is absolutely awesome. But then also, on our website, we ask them, oh, who of our young people want to participate in the trip with the European Union to go and get the Nobel Peace Prize? I mean, we can't have our members involved with kind of this bullshit, but how am I to change this? And because there's so much good stuff, and we can really use their means and the money they have and the contacts they have, but there's so many, it's hard. Bad stuff as well.
Mm.
And how do you know what's right, and how do you know what's wrong?
Mm. Yeah,
flip.
Yeah. What I want to say continues a bit on the money trap case. I think there are a lot of NGOs with people who just have totally different opinions, and for the discussion here, I don't think they're really interesting. And the interesting aspect of discussion is people who have somehow good intentions, or organizations that were doing very good things in the beginning, get into some kind of unavoidable or maybe affordable direction of because of being dependent on money, and then you have to ensure your income, so you have to give a message that I don't know, people like, or funders like, or donors like, or and also bureaucracy. You in the end you have to somehow sustain yourself or your organization, and all your time goes into this. It's a bit similar to you were saying. Like, that's for me. And then on the other side, yeah, somehow you can. It also has advantages. I think you also should acknowledge that. Sometimes it's very difficult only to organize things in your free time next to a difficult job to make your money. It's nice that there are some people that somehow have some funding to do some organizing. And but when is it okay, and under which circumstances is it okay, and how do you avoid the threats?
Yeah, I also had a speech by Arundhati Roy about this. Was talking specifically about India and how like big foundations like the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, these kind of institutions basically use have lots of money and use the power they have with that kind of money to funnel it through a lower level NGOs, who then go down to another lower level of NGOs who are doing the grassroots work, and in that way can shape the type of work that goes done by the money trap or whatever it's called. So I guess it's a way of capital or whatever to push social movements into maybe less effective or less confrontational or kind of work, or more system confirming work.
So that would be the aspect of a kind of the question of what the interests of foundations actually are, and then the sort of more so not just the kind of good intentions get foiled by bureaucracy, but actually there's a political agenda as well.
Yeah, but it's also that like groups like Greenpeace are nowadays more or less guided by their funding and PR department, because that makes the whole organization tick. So they're really afraid to do anything that could offend the millions of donors they have. So they're afraid to, for instance, pick up the whole car issue, because. Yeah, it's difficult to sell to their donors. Mm. And for instance, for Greenpeace, they don't take funding from companies or whatever. But that's already determining the strategy they take. But on the other hand, what Flip says. I'm pretty jealous on the type and stuff that Greenpeace has to do actions. I wish we could organize our funding that properly, that we could do the same.
I don't know, because they are pretty ineffective, but if you see the amount of people that they have working with them, you know, to produce these actions, the return on investment is not very high, I would say. Mm.
I'm just pulling up one example. One concrete encounter I had with NGOs where I got incredibly angry was actually during the G8 mobilization in Germany 5 years ago, where there was a major mobilization going on. It was also clear that the street protests and actual blockades of the summit would be a major focus. And there was this kind of conference where they tried to bring together all kind of groups, activist groups, networks, and NGOs. To coordinate this week of protest. And then it was clear that the NGOs had meanwhile already made a plan to make their, what also often happens with these kind of mass protests, their counter-conference, where they would discuss alternatives and have good speakers to explain why the G8 is a problem, or neoliberalism, or privatization, or whatever. And that was all fine. The point was that the more activist networks, where I was part from, wanted at least that this conference would not take place on the major, on the first day of the G8, where the major blockade should take place. And I remember there was this kind of debating and blah blah blah, but at the end it was very clear that the NGOs would never do that, because they had it already planned like this, and probably they had already some important speakers booked just for that day, so they wouldn't change that anymore, and they just went on with their plan. So that was kind of, we felt very counterproductive to send out the message of, yeah, protest, blockade the G8, and at the same time there is this nice conference where you can see big shots like, I don't know, who, David Harvey, and la la la. But for sure, it was a possibility, it didn't happen, like enough at the end. But lots of people go to this conference instead of doing this one day of action. Well, the frustration that, or what I realized in that moment is that for sure, I mean, you can blame this, maybe they're just evil, or maybe it's because of funding reasons, what was mentioned, but it's also that NGOs have their own agendas, and they often go beyond specific mobilizations and so on, and therefore it's sometimes very difficult to let it resonate with the agendas of grassroots movements.
So it's a pure practical point. There's no evil intention behind it.
I don't say, and maybe it is evil intention, but I think it comes also out of the fact that they are much more structured organizations who have more long-term goals, and therefore, yeah, make just plans that can totally be against the plans that a mobilization or a movement is having at the moment.
Yeah. But small small groups and individuals within grassroots movements can also often have their own agenda.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's for an NGO that you the problem is bigger.
Yeah, because yeah.
It's not just with NGOs.
But you don't have a hidden agenda,
or no, you go. Well, I've seen a lot of partners. I think there are a lot of people participating in things with more or less hidden or.
No, but what I mean is, if you mount a campaign, you say, okay, we are going to try to come together to organize this and this, you assume that the people that come there really want to organize this and this, and are not there because in reality they want to organize something else, or what sometimes happens, they want it to not succeed, so that something else that they, I mean, that's what I mean, and if activists have that, they can do it once, but then they get thrown out and nobody wants to work with them anymore. But I had one other thing that is also practical, is that we discovered that NGOs change their plans every year. And this can be so damaging for campaigns. Like, for instance, you decide that there's something, like, for instance, this new, I forgot the name, with the Lomé countries, the free trade agreements. Doesn't matter how it's called. It was a long negotiation thing in the WTO and outside of it, and all these NGOs sat together with activists, and we decided, okay, we need to mount a campaign. And then after a year, Oxfam pulls back their money because they had suddenly decided that trade is not their core business anymore. So, I mean, you had made all kind of agreements, and it's the same. They make their own plans, which go contrary to what you need as a network. And also people just move out again. They're being pulled out. They came to your meetings for a few times, they know everything about it, and then they decide that they have to move to another dossier, and so that this person is not there anymore.
I can imagine. Well, Netherlands is a bit of paradise for NGOs, at least compared to countries like Portugal or Turkey. Or, I've been also in a kind of organization in Turkey. People were trying to create, we don't have this kind of funds to organize a political team. And I think at the end, the results are much more positive than negative, I think. At least there is lots of people, lots of discussion, lots of information and knowledge that circulates, and it provides some kind of basis for political action and political ideas, which is not so good. Other kind of practical things: if you want to go to the World Social Forum, you don't need only to be organized; you need money. I went to one in Brazil, so it was 1,000 euros that travel. I went because I was in an organization that could pay for a group of people to be there, so it's somehow expectable that when people start to organize, if there are some funds, people try to get it. Of course, the mechanisms are not so subtle to it's normally written. You have to fit your activity in some kind of programs, and of course, each NGO has its own agenda, like a trade union or a political party. Everybody has its own agenda, and we have to deal with that, I think. Then it's a matter, I think, of trust. Then you have to find for specific actions, specific campaigns, who can work with you, then you see after 2-3 years who is trustable and who is not trustable. But I think we have to deal with the fact that any organization has its own agenda, its own priorities, because the fans are here, because the members have a specific opinion about the issue. Sometimes it's not so many members, then they don't want to do something that maybe it was more interesting according to our opinion. And then another thing is that when it becomes too much professional, which also I think covers lots of other kind of organizations, I don't think it's bad in itself to become professional, to have some people working professionally for an organization, but it's bad that it becomes too long. I think it should be very the most rotating.
Dynamic,
yes, 2 years, 3 years, but if it becomes 5, 6, 7 years, so people aren't defending their own jobs after certain moments. It's not all, it becomes a bit of personal agenda. And that makes everything more complicated, but again, we have to deal with that, because each organization belongs to their members, not to the other people. So we cannot say you should do this, you should do that. But we can make some pressure, but anyway, they are they take decisions about their own organizations.
I think it works pacification in hands. Mm. And it's easy to be member, but not to be active. And I'll keep it short.
So it's kind of like a pacification.
Pacification, yeah.
But also a pacification as well, in a way. Like, that's not a word, but... Yeah. It's kind of both, you know, pacifies, but also makes passive as well.
And salary of board members.
Board members, anything else?
I don't have those experiences of long-term involvement and maybe disappointments at NGOs, but you know, I have some, like working formally on some projects now and then. And now I have in my hands an opportunity to organize something pretty interesting in a large international gathering. And yeah, I am always again split between these issues, so I would like to go with some hopeful interventions. The thing that you know comes up very often is that the way that they have to manage their budgets, the way they have to manage their image, we said PR, you know, almost branding, it's ultimately that those hidden agendas are because that they work like corporations that we have, you know, do the same criticisms or parties or the. If their you know, long-term engagements are you know, incompatible with what we want to do, could it work on these short-term one-off cases? You know, I will have no access in their longer strategic plans or whatever, but how can I hijack this specifically the event as much as possible? So,
maybe you can take it from here.
I'm going to take it from here.
Still not
okay.
For debate as well.
Okay. I mean, I think we probably collected all of the issues that arise in terms of the discussions about NGOs in the present. And I'm I'm reminded of a newspaper article that Case will remember this as well. I think with the G20 and the G20 protest in London in April 2009, in the Financial Times, the day after the protests, there was a newspaper article that portrayed this picture of an anti-capitalist meeting where everybody was sitting around evaluating their protest and whether or not, in terms of their key performance indicators, they had successfully brought down capitalism or not. And that they had to conclude that, unfortunately, on this occasion, they hadn't quite been successful, and therefore, their managers were not going to get any bonus payout. And, of course, for the Financial Times, this was hilarious, because, you know, these anti-capitalists, these who were sat in this supposed room, hadn't met their key performance indicators of bringing down the system. And therefore they weren't going to get their bonuses. But to me, that really encapsulated a lot of the problem of the NGO spectrum in terms of where the context in which NGOs have arisen and what has happened to NGOs over the years and where we are now, I think, in terms of understanding what's going on with NGOs. So I'd like to take us back perhaps to an earlier moment in time and thinking about what context NGOs actually arise and what NGOs actually are. So I think the first NGOs really emerge after the Second World War, but it isn't so they as environment there's environmental movements, not movements, but sort of organizations that are working quite closely with governments. And it's in the context of kind of the 1980s, late 1970s, 1980s, so with the crisis of the Keynesian state, the crisis of capitalism at the time, that the NGO really arises as a form of organization. And it's a form of organization that doesn't necessarily come from radical movements or come from social movements. It's a form of organization that comes from the UN, it comes from governments. I think it's actually even the United Nations where this term non-governmental organization is first used, right? So I think it's important for us to remember.
Yeah, well, at certain parts of the United Nations, you have a non-governmental, you can become a non-governmental observer.
That's right.
Shell, for example, is a non-governmental observer.
That's right. So starting with like thinking about, okay, what is a non-governmental organization? It's any form of organization that's not a government. So it can be anything. I mean, when I remember somebody saying to me once, it can be anything from Shell to the Mafia to an anti-capitalist group campaigning on something in specific. So in the first instance, an NGO means just a non-governmental organization. So I think for us, the first thing we have to bear in mind is what aspect of NGOs are we actually interested in? Like, what are our concerns with NGOs? Because obviously we're not concerned with every single NGO. We're not concerned with every single non-governmental organization. So that's why I think understanding where they come from and understanding how they arise helps us to sort of focus the mind. And that's why we think of the 1980s and we think of the crisis of the state and the development also of particular forms of governance, so governance models where not only the state is involved in policy making, but also other kinds of organizations are doing certain things for governments. So whether that is service provision, where the state cuts back certain things, so welfare state retrenchment and the crisis of the Keynesian state, NGOs come in as service providers, so doing various things that governments did beforehand. So if you think public services, then it's more and more NGOs doing this, or it's research that's being done and then fed back to governments, or it's advocacy, lobbying work, campaigning, awareness raising. There's all sorts of different things that NGOs do, and they specialize in doing them. Some NGOs have a particular interest in social justice issues, but other NGOs don't really. I mean, I think that we could probably safely say that the organizations that we're interested in this conversation are the NGOs that are involved in some kind of social justice or social change kind of work, whether that's in terms of providing services, whether that's in terms of doing research or awareness raising or indeed lobbying. And I think a lot of the time some of the frustrations that come up are also with organizations that are working quite closely with governments in terms of lobbying and advocacy. So their interest seems to become more in influencing government policy than working with social movements in a grassroots way. So I think once we kind of get that context, we can perhaps be more specific about what it is that we're really concerned with. So on the one hand, it's the retrenchment of the state or the reorganization of the state. At another level, it's also globalization and this development of a kind of international realm of governance as well, where the NGO becomes a very important actor at the United Nations, but also other, not so much the World Trade Organization, but certainly as time progresses, various international organizations inviting NGOs into the process and civil society dialogue becoming more and more important. And there certainly, if one looks at, say for example, because you mentioned the G8, say for example the G8, it's quite clear looking at the policy documents of the G8 and looking also at the think tank documentation also of something like the Trilateral Commission, which is the commission of the states that influence the G8, and so this basically we're talking about the US, the UK, and Japan, etc., that they were interested in having closer collaboration with civil society organizations precisely because of the legitimacy deficit that they faced. So you can trace a quite clear strategy of using NGOs for a certain kind of legitimization. So I think that's one area where we can say, okay, there's an issue to do with what we might want to call co-option, but also we can see that this was never about bringing organizations in necessarily to because they are advocating a certain kind of change that's been taken on board, but there's a lot of documents that state quite clearly we need to do something about our image and we need to make sure that free trade is something that people actually believe in and that we shouldn't give too much ground to movements. Therefore, we need to be seen to be engaging in this way with civil society organizations. So I think that's one issue. Another issue is the way that in the context of the crisis of Keynesianism, the crisis of the 1970s, obviously the neoliberal project emerges as a very specific kind of project, which is about the retrenchment of the state in certain areas, but it's also about the rolling out of the market, right? And it's about an increasing privatization of all sorts of realms of social life that beforehand perhaps fell under the remit of the state or were considered to be outside of the market. And I'd say a second observation in that respect would be that NGOs have not been outside of that development either, so that a certain kind of way of organizing within NGOs has been, on the one hand, this problem of the relationship to philanthropic funders and their agendas, and then of course the issue of the ties to particular kinds of foundations and what their agenda might be, but also how the way that an NGO has to report to their funders, how they have to organize themselves in certain ways to have these kinds of accountabilities to funders, how that shapes the organization, but also how increasingly NGOs themselves are having to function like businesses. Right? So actually today, I think what we see is certainly still the issue of philanthropy and foundations and a political agenda around that, but also how NGOs themselves are business organizations. So social enterprises, for example, that are the kind of new form of NGO that have to be self-sustaining, or that actually now if you look at Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and all of these financial investment firms, they are very interested in this terrain as well, in terms of setting up their own kinds of social enterprises or giving money to social enterprises. So I think there again, this kind of professionalization that we have seen over time is also has a particular kind of trajectory in terms of a marketization or a corporatization that's not just in form, it's not just that people have become more like professionals, but actually there are financial kind of interests connected. So I think the issues that we have are, on the one hand, this issue around funding and certain agendas, and of course the role of governments in terms of legitimizing themselves, but also using NGOs to provide certain services for them. The relationship to movements, so in the way that sometimes there is quite good collaborations where, for example, if I think about in 1988, there was the protests against the IMF in Berlin, and there I did some interviews with some of the activists who were mobilizing at the time, and they were saying to me, well, we understood ourselves as having a division of labor. We understood that some of the NGOs were involved in lobbying work, and other groups would be out on the streets and organizing the protests, and there was a continuum, right? There was an understanding that everybody was doing their bit to actually change the world. Whereas if you look later on, say in 2005, at the G8 protests in Scotland, when the G8 was in the UK, there was more of a sense that actually there were parts of the movement that were on the street that were not the same as those organizations that were talking to government, so that there was a disconnect. Now, I think that has to do with not only the development of this kind of civil society dialogue that serves a particular kind of legitimation, but I think it also has to do with the way that a kind of social justice industry has developed, in which actually a lot of people who now work for some of the big NGOs they haven't necessarily gone through a process of politicization. They have studied NGO management in business schools. They have studied NGOs in some other kind of way and see it as a job that they do, and then they want to do to the best of their abilities. Actually, I'm not saying that people are not doing something that they believe in, but that the way in which perhaps 20 years previously campaigning was organized as a means to an end, today a lot of those means have become ends in themselves. So you have your key performance indicators, you have your way that things have always been done. It's this kind of very professionalized way. And I think that when we talk about professionalization, what we're really talking about is a depoliticization, and that actually talking about politics has become incredibly difficult, because the way that things are done, the way that an NGO is supposed to be run, has become the central kind of focus. So I think those are some of the issues, and perhaps the where we are now is we're also in a total crisis, right? I think that NGOs are in a crisis. The ones that we're in, I'm talking now social justice related NGOs, are in a total crisis because of funding. Those philanthropic organizations that they have tried to get funding from over the years are also not giving that money anymore in the same way. They are increasingly organizations are supposed to run more like businesses. There is financial capital entering into these areas in very specific ways. But also, I think there is a crisis of politics within the NGOs themselves, and I've certainly talked with a lot of people in the UK who really recognize this problem of a means becoming ends, who say, well, we want economic justice. Okay, but what does that mean? Well, we want people to kind of go on the streets and do something. Well, do what? We want people to move. Well, move for what? So there's a kind of sort of way in which things have been done in certain ways for quite a long time, but there is some kind of disconnect. So I think there is a lot of soul searching within NGOs, but I think probably, and maybe this is a provocation and maybe you will agree, I do think at the same time there has come a sector of those sorts of social justice NGOs that are perhaps really on the other side in many ways now. And that is perhaps a reality that we have to face in our movements, and we have to call it what it is, right? And we have to not keep just saying everybody has to work together, but actually we have to say we're not on the same side. But we are actually on the same side still with some NGOs, but the question has to be politics, and the question has to be shifting power relations and moving together, and not simply everyone always has to work together because that's how we change things. Over to you guys.
Thank you. I think that was quite some thought-provoking stuff to discuss more about, and maybe we can just get some reaction. Emma's more general and historical talk to look at the development of the NGOs and the problems we're facing right now, and maybe also the proposal at the end how to deal with it, and gather just some reactions and from there discuss. Go ahead.
You made a distinction about like everything is an NGO which is not governmental. So what are we talking about? First of all, we talk about those entities that are active on social justice issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing we are talking about is the professionalized entities that at least have a staff, something like that. I mean, to frame it in a bit. And I was wondering if you agree, you've been studying the developments of NGOs and social movements. Because it suddenly made me, your story reminded me of how at the end of the 90s, they were in the same crisis. And I got the idea that professional NGOs always produce their own failure in a way. Because they, just as, like trade unions, real trade unions hate an active membership, NGOs also don't like, you know, when those people that they should be paying their fees and let them do the work, you know. And because of that, I mean, you can't produce any real threat anymore, because the only thing that does that is if you have an angry constituency that goes into the street and does unruly things and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they lose them because they're not providing any of those things anymore, and then become powerless, and then become in a crisis, and then, I mean, I remember when the globalization movement suddenly happened in 1999, around that, they were desperate for activists and for people, and so that this opened a complete, they had to invite all these people that they normally don't want to have there, and then what happens, they regain credibility, they build up that again, and then they take over, and then they try to pacify the thing. So I see this movement, and a good example of how it works in Holland, because it was a bit theoretical, was that there was an international call for a day of, I don't know exactly what it was agriculture and trade. It was a really good manifesto, and everybody at all, this was when the globalization movement was gaining strength. So also in Holland we thought, hey, this is great. And some of the NGOs, Oxfam, HIFOS, both ends, they also wanted to participate, because in those days, it was 2005, 2006, you had to, otherwise if you were not there, you would have lost a lot of attention. And to my surprise, they invited all kind of also us, and we were sitting there, and they said, yeah, the manifesto is, no, they didn't even say it. I discovered that they had a completely different text than the International Manifesto. Everywhere, everybody worked with the manifesto saying capitalism is problematic, neoliberalism is destroying small farmers, you know, all the right things. And they clearly had met some of these NGO people, and they decided, no, we're not going to follow this radical campaign. Let's hope they don't notice it. And they changed it into something bolder, you know, about everywhere there is criticism on the way economics are working and stuff like that. And so this is so typical. And another problem that was not the people like us that are not in these NGOs or at least don't have it as a paid job, they always lose out, because you don't have the time to do these preparations, you can't read all those books, you can't travel to international meetings and stuff like that, and you always have some kind of achterstandspositie in those structures, and it's a real problem.
You're running behind.
But isn't it, just to respond to that, isn't it also the problem, if we think about the history of NGOs, I wonder also whether, for us,
this issue always comes back to resources, in the sense that one of our problems now is we are so disenfranchised in so many ways that we can't reproduce ourselves as social movements. Like, we're always having to get, either we reclaim resources somehow, we squat buildings, or we do whatever it is that we do, but, or there have been lots of people who have decided to found NGOs to access resources, or to access governments, or to access spaces. So I think for us, the issue, because probably when we're talking about our movements, we're not talking about people who started out at the United Nations. We're starting out, we're talking about people who were involved in some kind of social justice work in which they saw the NGO form as a form which could be useful for movements. So it kind of comes the other way around, and that actually that is comes out of also a crisis of politics on the left, right, or in movements themselves, where we were also, many people were also asking the question of organization, and the NGO becomes a way, one way of organizing. So I think that this issue about resources and is really so central, because it also then, it also explains why NGOs become, the German is sich verselbstständigen, you know, like what's the English, even I can't remember. They become like they have to reproduce themselves as organizations, because that becomes the primary objective, which is why they also have to control movements. Like in the UK, Make the Bank Poverty History campaign, part of what they were about was controlling that movement so much so that any kind of connections that were made, any movement that was generated by the Make Poverty History campaign, had to be shut down afterwards. Because, like you say, next year trade was not going to be the issue. So, and any kind of movement from below would challenge their existence. So I really like some of the more radical NGOs in the UK, for example, War and Want, they talk about themselves and the work that they do is making themselves superfluous.
Yeah.
Like that's what they consider themselves to be doing. Making themselves superfluous. So it means that they...
Overfolded.
Yeah, so their work is to make themselves not exist anymore.
Yes, that's what you want.
Yeah, that's what you want. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the opposite of trying to maintain your organization.
I think it's also... was one of the things that I concluded after years working with and within NGOs. So it becomes really dangerous when it becomes real jobs, and when you're as a person, you become dependent on it, because it's also understandable if you don't have anything else to go.
Yeah.
But and then there were sometimes the discussion, it grows from, okay, somebody is putting a lot of time in something, and then you think it makes sense that this person gets some compensation, because you can do a lot of useful things if you get a few hundred euros and you don't have to work in a bar. But then you have sometimes discussions of labor rights, and then you're like, you're working on social justice or on social issues, and you want to support unions. And in the meantime, you don't have the same rights for yourself because you're just overexploiting yourself. And so you don't get out of it. I mean, it's at the same time impossible to get enough funding to really have normal jobs with normal rights, so you keep on exploiting yourself because you have to improve the world. So then I think, okay, I'm happy now that I first, my personal perspective, I have to work somewhere else and over exploit myself elsewhere, but I don't
have to do it in your movement,
but
work.
Not in my political work. But yeah, I see also the traps and the difficulties, but because this is difficult. If you grow as an organization, why would people working for your organization not have the rights for with normal income and the idea that they can still have the job in 2-3 years? It's logic, but
we've had a lot of labor struggles in the NGO sector in the last few years. We had Friends of the Earth went on strike, Amnesty International were on strike.
Not here.
No. So yeah, absolutely.
I think the other thing is that most of the successful social movements are the movements that seem to be able to pull together some money to free up some people to actually do lots of work that needs to be done and get resources into place. But then of course there's this whole problem that becomes a means instead of an end. But then the big question is how do you as a movement do that without
resources?
No, I think you need resources, but without stepping into this trap.
Okay.
but it's a discussion. I don't think you're right that the most successful are the ones that professionalized. I mean, the squatting movement in Amsterdam or in Holland was very successful. In 2 years' time, they got rid of speculation in the whole city without ever employing anybody. I mean, there's many examples of amateuristic movements that achieve success any other way around, like professional. Like I said, the return on investment is often horrible. If you see how much money is being spent, like for the financial transaction tax in all these Oxfams, and I mean, what do they achieve? Nothing at all. And there's hundreds of people working on that dossier.
The more so since all the research work had already been done before by voluntary researchers.
That's another problem, of course, like claiming or hijacking results because they need to deliver.
Now, there is an interesting debate, in fact, because what groups or what movements are more successful? That's also a very huge question in social movements. I'm sure a lot of academics said. Write about or wrote once about it, but in fact you can divide it into camps, and there's one who really believe that it's the movements that organize best and that are able to allocate resources. Therefore, so for them, they look also when they look at social movements, they look at organizations, and they look at how are movements able to recruit money and people and time, for access to politicians and I don't know what decision making structures. It's certainly an interesting way, but you can't indeed, and I, in that sense, I agree also with the other camp, explain a lot of movements, at least, maybe not all, but a lot of movements you can't explain like this, their success. And then there's a number of other studies from this other camp that shows, well, it also has to do with forms of power. What forms of power do movements have? Well, it's hard to describe their different concepts, but one I do like is the power of disruption. One power that social movement have is grassroots movement, not the organizations, that they can disrupt the normal affairs of things. And through that, not only just like point out problems and say, look here, but actually create pressure, right? I mean, make it difficult for the opponents and so on. So I think this kind of power is a power that through the NGOification of social justice issues, as Emma was describing, was getting lost a lot. And it's very difficult to reclaim it, at least together with NGOs, because I think NGOs are really for a big part not interested in that, and even if they might be, they probably cannot do this. This power of disruption is not their strength. Their power is allocating resources. And so, what I think what strategically could help of this is to think about NGOs more indeed as these kind of taps of resources where when we can access those resources, interesting. If not, then we have to find our own resources and build up our own. And that depends probably on the case and the concrete struggle. But also to realize disruption is also a very powerful weapon of movements. And for that, we probably don't need any kind of NGO at all. That's just a question of people organizing.
On the contrary.
Maybe. Yeah, to the contrary, yes.
Because they try to pacificate again or to...
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
Yeah.
He was first. You were first.
No.
I would like to raise the question, is it even possible for a movement to grow that big without organizing themselves and in a way becoming like NGOs? Is it even possible to have that many members or sympathizers of your movement without governments suppressing you down again?
Yes, it's not very easy. CNT in Spain had more than 1 million members, and they had one paid person to do the administration.
What was this?
In
1936. But there was also a global crisis, and it was kind of
similar. I'm happy you said this, because I can add on that and what you were saying. Because reflecting on my own experience with NGO, I kind of come to the conclusion that what actually is most effective in NGOs is a very top layer that influences decision makers. And what is very effective is the bottom, not of NGOs, but social movement. And I have to call it the bottom because that's the way it is perceived, which influence so much the agenda which framed the discussion that the top layer cannot escape raising the issue and forefronting it to decision makers. And the big problem with NGO is actually the middle layer. That's where all the professionals are, who are taking over, appropriating everything that volunteers are doing, or people in the movement and so. And that bureaucratization or professionalization of NGOs is exactly where I think the most of us encounter problems. I don't want to say that the big shots of NGO are very good people, whereas the underlies are nothing. But there are the people who cannot escape what comes from down and do mediate it to the top. And that's the way that at least some very small progress, say human rights, say things like the International Criminal Court, these kind of things come into being. Very slowly, but they do advance.
I can say something. Well, maybe this crisis and the budget cuts do something against the bureaucratization of the NGOs, because they do not have the same resources. But anyway, I think we have a very depressing view on these questions in Europe in the last 10, 20 years. But if we were in Latin America, maybe we had the contrary idea. And if you see how the European Social Forum lost importance each year, and we see what was happening in Latin America with the World Social Forum, is completely different. And I don't know the situation so well, but in fact they managed not only to raise points, not only to disrupt, but also somehow they transformed very much the government and all the political context in Latin America now. And still with big conflicts. We see that the Without Land people, Santerra or Via Campesina, they still have big conflicts with the so-called leftist governments in Brazil or Bolivia. But still they somehow cooperate to... They know that they prefer Dilma or Lula than the military people in the 80s or the 90s. But it's still a very conflictive relation. All of them keep some autonomy to criticize and to criticize very violently, but somehow there is a more interesting, I would say, dynamics of these social movements and at the same time a very relevant political transformation.
But isn't that exactly the difference, that there are real social movements in Latin America and they disappeared here partly because of how NGOs emerged, but also I don't know. I also think it's not the case of only like complaining about NGOs and whatever. I mean, the solution is also, of course, to work on building grassroots movements. I mean, that's yeah. obvious.
Yeah.
But it's become really difficult in Europe. That's clear.
Well, the main frustration you ended with saying that not all NGOs are on our side, but the big frustration is, of course, NGOs that change side.
Yeah. But I also wonder how long the NGO is going to be around for. I don't think the NGO is actually going to be around for very much longer. Like, I think if we understand an NGO as an historical moment, it's an organizational form that emerges in a particular context. I think it arises with the neoliberal project. It's changed. I wonder now, like I think in the UK, I see a lot of organizations that are now setting themselves up as community interest companies, as social enterprises, these things. I don't know, this is just a speculation now, but I wonder whether the political economy of what is happening in the crisis is actually changing this NGO terrain again in a way that says they're not going to exist in the same way. I don't know, but it seems that something's pointed in that area.
What I see is that change is that now governments leave more to companies, like you have those roundtables and things, where governments want the different groups, different companies, NGOs, and probably also civil society organizations to organize themselves with new conflicts, but still the same NGOs. And I don't really, I see this more as a new development, which is still coming up. Governments are actually funding it, but then they fund the process, not the NGO. And both the NGOs and the companies and the governments wants to keep it or wants to this way. I don't see it disappear in a few years, and those NGOs will survive.
Part of the underlying, one of the other things you see happening is that in the past you need a big organization to get lots of funding. To get subsidies or to get lots of donations, and what you see now is that it's coming more and more easy for small groups to do that. The subsidies are gone, but for donations, the whole internet payment makes it incredibly easy for small groups to raise money like that in that way. And lots of the donators are sick of all the big loans of NGO bosses and the whole bureaucracy, and they're shifting towards the small groups that they still have influence on. So that's also something that, that I think indeed, well, some will survive, but lots of NGOs will find themselves in trouble. Mm-hmm.
Maybe one way to ask this again is, you know, to distribute the money might be shifting to small organizations, but they are precisely the small organizations. If there is, like what you said, a soul searching in those big NGOs, well, in one sense you say that corporations don't have a soul, so why should the NGOs have? If there is such thing, well, it's, you know, again, to twist the saying, if the NGOs had changed anything, they would be illegal. So not just an economic sustainability of these corporations, but their legality. And by legality, I don't just mean, you know, making them illegal terrorist organizations, but look at WikiLeaks, you know, exactly relying on these online donations, the donations get cut in very brutal and shady ways. So we are standing there.
No, I guess I was just thinking about this sort of the thing about NGOs becoming of changing. I mean, I think some will survive in the sense that they provide certain services. But I was just thinking, like in the context of the UK, what is happening now that these government contracts that are being given out, because we're talking about the contracts, their government contracts are being given out to social enterprises that are involved with the big banks and with private equity firms and financial investors. And what they're doing in turn is it's almost like they are taking over the smaller organizations, such that these smaller organizations can't actually...
Social enterprises, are they like a maatschappelijk verantwoord ondernemer kind of, is that the same thing?
I think so.
So a social enterprise is a company that trades for a social purpose.
Right.
Not a uniquely for-profit company.
It is for-profit.
It is
for-profit.
Not uniquely for the profit.
The only stipulation is that it has to have a social purpose. So it has to produce some kind of social value. But the way that social value is calculated is usually in terms of a cost-saving mechanism. So the social value is the free volunteer, right? Who gets to help the world and make it better, but that actually saves money.
That was from the state point of view. That was also the purpose of NGOs. Mm. At least in the Netherlands, NGOs were the big NGOs, which can be better. Officially they are MFOs. That means co-financing organizations.
Yeah.
Basically, meaning they get money from the taxpayers, as it's called it, and then redistribute it. And they were an arm, or they are an arm of the state. And then the idea behind it was cost saving. Because NGOs were far cheaper also in terms of personnel than state employees.
But officially, they were independent.
In the same
way that public media are being subsidized by the state, but
claim not to be be the voice of the state.
Yeah, I don't know how much time we still have. Not much.
We're going to wait until they kick us
so
out.
So far, it was a very interesting and also useful analysis of NGOs and problems. But the question I feel
what's
how to deal with them? How, when to work together with them in the which conditions, or when not to work together with them, or how to campaign against them? And maybe we wouldn't have time. This would be the question to answer.
Well, we can if we have another room.
Yeah. No, but I, but it's also a difficult problem because they are changing all the time. I mean, you can if we know we'd come to an agreement. Well, we can do this with NGOs, and we should not we should be careful about that. Then it's in a year time. It might be invalid. NGOs have changed a lot of character in the say past 20 years.
Yeah.
And there's another problem.
For instance, participation.
Well. And there's another thing, it's NGOs are, but then I came late in the discussion, but NGOs are very different from one country to the next. In France, for instance, you hardly have NGOs, as we know that. In Holland, in the Netherlands, they are very different animals from what they are in the United Kingdom. And then they are again different from Germany, so it's also something that has to be factored in, if I may say so.
But there are big international ones, they more or less do the same.
But I guess, I mean, my question or my proposal would be to say, well, actually, we need to start with our politics, right? We actually, as movements, we need to start with what it is that we're trying to do. And I think it's that has often gotten lost in terms of we lack the spaces, we lack the commitment, we lack the continuity in our movements to have those discussions about politics so that we could hold any NGOs that we would be working with to account to a political process, right? So I think that to me is the question. So it's.
But it's only the half of the answer, because the other, there has to be a critical watch of what NGOs are doing and people
NGO
are being informed.
Sure. Yeah. Which there, I mean, there are.
And this is very difficult because especially in the time of political crisis of the left, you know, where you don't want to be nitty-bitting, what is called, about everything, you know, it is difficult to have a fruitful, critical discussion and sometimes say, okay, you really can't do this. Like, and Pax Christi is, for instance, they started as a peace movement and then became advocates for interventions in Afghanistan. Right? I mean, this is, I mean, people, and they're still being seen as a progressive group that you can invite if you need information on what's happening there.
But that to me goes together with then the questions of politics, right? It's also to then have the courage to say as a movement, well, this isn't actually, you know, this is actually going against what we're trying to do, and to stop trying to fudge stuff, which I think is often.
Or actually start campaigns.
Or start campaigns, yeah.
Like we, for instance, are for years about offering a overstop service.
What?
Overstop service.
Transfer.
Offer people the service to cancel the donation for WWF and shift them to us. really clear provocation to the WWF politics on lots of issues. And yeah, really attack them and start a discussion.
Talking about that, that's also often difficulty with working with some NGOs that if you talk with them informally, they agree on what you think. But they want to keep peace within the NGO movement. And they don't, they also disagree with other NGOs, they don't like what they're doing, but they don't openly want to campaign against others. That's a very strong mechanism somehow, and with WWF that's also big problem. The more the other NGOs that are actually really against their policy don't openly dare to say this. And that's actually between the small thing. And even 30th of November there's this silence of Panda, the pact in Panda about WWF on the Dutch television. Finally, after some court cases, they're allowed to show it.
Shall we take Jesper as a last intervention, and I think we have to wrap up then, because kind of...
I forgot. Well, I wanted to talk about the World Social Forum, because it's
actually there, you can see all of these points are relevant there, and we see this confusion in the NGO circles. There's no funding. They try to get it from governments now and other, and but like the big funders like Oxfam, they don't want to give as much as they used to give, and they actually already counted this money. So, and the also interesting to see is that they really want, like you said, like the people, they understand what is happening at the the bottom. They have seen the movements, what they call the movements of 2011, the Arab Spring, Occupy, Mihnada, those movements. They want to invite them, but they are really, they don't know how. They send letters like, we want to invite the NGOs of the Occupy movement. The NGOs, like they expect them to be organized in the same way. So this is, but now, yeah. We
should send Zeitgeist people to them.
Just one thing, I got in. I was attending World Forum for Democracy last October in Strasbourg, and because I know I'm befriended with someone who organizes this, and we had 170 invitations, and I contacted so many activist groups all over Europe, all over the world, to come to the fucking World Forum for Democracy and tell what they have to say. Do you know what they said? No, we're not interested. We're not doing that kind of thing. And this is ridiculous. I was the only one, together with an activist from New York.
But that was organized by the European Union.
There
was an action against it. It was called Occupy Fake Democracy.
It was a counter for.
Okay. We're gonna have that debate. I think we have to wrap up because people here really want to set up a space for tonight.
We don't have another space.
No,
I feel like we could actually continue the discussion if we can.
Yeah, maybe in the bar.
Yeah.
I think the bar is not nice, and it's also going to be dinner in a while.
It's
right?
at the
another place, yeah.
That's you have to walk there, that takes half an hour.
Yeah, that's true.
So we can start walking. Yeah. We have a little manifestation.
Yes, exactly.
more in the years.
But either way, thanks for everyone.
Thank you.
And I'd be really interested if you could, did you, apart from broadcasting this, also record it?
Yeah, I did.
It would be great to have, and you were, you know, I thought it was really productive and interesting.
Yep.
I hope we can all produce some information to spread this. It would be,
And it's going to be an every case a written report?
Yeah,
more or
less. Okay. I had difficulty.
Okay, we can also use that.
Yeah,
to make a little. The intention is always that there's written reports about all the workshops of 2DF5 on the website, which normally happens only 2 weeks or so afterwards. But we don't have a hurry. But just one more thing. This is part of four workshops that were organized in 2DF5 to look at four problematic actors who stand in the way or sometimes not of movements. Three were today on political parties, trade unions, and this one on NGOs. Tomorrow there is another one, the last one, on
academics.
Put someone, make a picture of the books.
Yeah.
Make a picture with the...